Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today we are talking about Ocean's 11, the 2001 Steven Soderbergh film. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, writer Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Writer Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And editor Alex Calleros.
Hello.
So Ocean's 11 is one of my favorite movies. I think maybe it's the first heist movie I saw, but I immediately then became obsessed with heist movies and wanting to both make them but also be in them.
Uh-huh.
Like, I want to just be George Clooney wearing a suit coming up an escalator in that one shot.
Of course.
Like everybody
so,
does.
Right. Yeah. It's so much fun. And it might have been my first Steven Soderbergh movie that I saw.
Wow.
But there's just so many things I love about this movie, the style and the energy of it and the cast and the meta humor is just so up my alley. So I want to talk about all these things. But yeah, I'm curious for you guys. Did you guys get to see this in theaters? What was your first experience with this?
I saw this in the movie theater. I already was a heist movie fan. So my dad was obsessed with The Sting, which is like the most dad movie ever. Like, and he would tell us stories about how The Sting played for a year in his hometown theater.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, there's one screen or whatever. And if they're still selling tickets to a movie, they're just going to keep showing that movie. So, and this movie, I feel like, inherits a lot from The Sting. Like, the dynamic between George Clooney and Brad Pitt in this movie is sort of very similar to Paul Newman and Robert Redford.
Never thought of that, but yeah, makes a lot of sense.
So I got so excited when this movie was coming out. Went and saw it in the theater, rocked my world. I think I went back and tried to see it again the next day, or at least that same weekend, and just have basically been obsessed with it ever since. I have the soundtrack. I love the soundtrack too. It's just a wonderful movie.
Yeah. Brian, what about you? When did you first see it?
I'm pretty sure I saw it in the theater. I weirdly actually can't remember, because I remember then the next thing that happened was my roommate in college said, hey, can you download Ocean's 11 for us? We want to watch it. Because I knew how to do that stuff. So I did.
So sketchy.
I know. But then I had Ocean's 11, so I was able to watch it whenever I wanted. Mm-hmm. Then I definitely saw 12 and 13 in the theater, because by then I was in on whatever they were going
to
do.
It holds up really well on rewatch. Like, it's one of those things that you can continue to like mine for all of its lines. Stuff blows by you the first time you see it, so it's rewarding when you watch it again.
And it's also just there aren't a lot of movies that are just so fun that I think I could put on Ocean's 11 once a year for the rest of my life and not get tired of it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, Alex, when did you first see it?
I probably saw it in theaters, but like Brian, I can't remember, actually. It's kind of just, I just know that I've always seen it. Like, Ocean's 11 is part of my memory, and I don't know when it happened. It made such an imprint on me because it just felt like it defined cool for me for
totally.
Like the rest of my life, maybe. Like, it was just like, this is what it means to be cool, is to be these people, like, walking around looking like this.
Yeah,
with this
yeah.
music playing and with these shots, and this is it. So I feel like it just was very, like, defining to me as far as, like, what it looks like to be a cool person in a movie is like Ocean's 11.
I think the thing that helps create that is this particular movie's version of Vegas, which is not at all how Vegas is, right?
Like, yeah. Right.
We live in LA, so we've all been to Vegas, and it is difficult at the best of times.
It doesn't feel this effortless and wonderful.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, it's not a magical world of fun and cool
and money and just beautiful people and all of that stuff.
You don't have the shot of them sweating on the sidewalk trying to get from between one
sucking on like big slurpees in the shape of the Eiffel Tower.
Well, even that scene where they're at the fountain at the end, like, if that's anywhere 9 months out of the year, it's 100 degrees at night, like, waiting 15 minutes to watch the Bellagio fountains. I tried it once and I was like, I can't be out here. It's 100 degrees. It's midnight. It's terrible.
Yeah. And I think I think it also kind of defined cool for me as well in a lot of ways. And I think the reason it worked on me is that it's a self-aware cool. Like, I think there's just so much self-aware humor in it. And I think one of the funniest things that just tickles me to no end is that toward the beginning, when George Clooney goes and recruits Brad Pitt, and they're at the poker game with all the TV stars, and Topher Grace is there. And then at the end of the game, they all walk out and there's screaming fans that come and swarm Topher Grace.
Ignoring
Brad Pitt and George Clooney walk by. Yeah. And that's just this is the funniest thing in the world to me. I don't know why, it just tickles me.
And of course, the line where George Clooney's talking to them, he says, oh, making the transition from TV to film, that must be hard.
Yeah.
See, I don't think I got that at the time, but yeah, that's so.
There's a lot I didn't get at the time. I mean, that was one of the things, even just watching it this week, it was fun to revisit it. And I don't think I've really seen it much since I was a teenager. Mm. And all these movies I saw when I was in middle school, high school, I loved them at the time, but I get so much more out of them now because I'm an adult and I've lived a life and I know what adult things are now. And it just, there's so much more to get out of these kind of childhood movies. And I always love revisiting them and realizing, wow, there's like three more layers to this scene than I ever picked up on in my original viewing.
I think the thing about what you were saying though, Michael, and you referenced this too, is that the movies are self-aware to an extent. You have to do it with a light touch, which this movie does really well. Like that scene is subtle. It's not a plot point. It's just like this cute moment where everyone swarms the TV stars. Topher Grace's expression where he's just like, oh man, paparazzi found me again. Rats. Like, but it's in the background, right? It isn't a plot point. Whereas contrasting it with later on where the series ends up going, particularly Ocean's 12, we don't like that kind of meta humor when it gets thrown in our faces in the same way. It doesn't feel as delightful. Like the, you know, that sense of discovery where you notice something meta that the characters don't seem to notice, that makes you feel like smart and clever and it lets you in on the joke. But when they're beating you over the head with the joke, like the Julia Roberts thing and Ocean's 12, you're just like, I don't like this.
Mm. Yeah. That is an interesting distinction because I remember being in the theater for Ocean's 11 and the fun that everyone was having in the audience. And I remember being in the theater for Ocean's 12 and the silent confusion and frustration that people were feeling. Because if you haven't seen Ocean's 12, spoiler alert, but there's a part where Julia Roberts, as part of the con, they bring her in to play a character that, because her character in the movie looks so much like Julia Roberts, they're making her pretend to be Julia Roberts in the movie in The Heist. And it's just like super meta. And like, it's weird because Ocean's 12, I did not like when I saw it in theaters, but I watched it again like at 3 a.m. in college with my friend one night. And it was like the best thing we'd ever seen.
Sure, sure.
So I have fond memories and I like it now. But yeah, Ocean's 11 had, I think, like you're saying, Trish, it had that light touch that made it this kind of magical, fun experience.
We talked about that moment, the Ocean's 12 moment, on I think our Shaun of the Dead podcast, where we talked about, are the characters aware that zombies exist in pop culture? And so the reason I like that in Ocean's 12 was because I feel like it's been done before. I think on Mork and Mindy, Robin Williams was in town, so he was playing Robin Williams and Mork, and people were confusing the two. But I just feel like, when have you ever seen that in a non silly comedy blockbuster type movie? And I just thought it was so funny, especially the way they build it up with Matt Damon saying, did you ever notice she looks, don't ever say that, you know? And then they think, so I thought it was like a fun, stupid thing, but I also understand why people think it's annoying.
I feel like you have to go into it like tuned to that wavelength,
right?
And if you're on that frequency, it's like, oh, this is fun, you're just doing this the whole movie. But if you're just sitting down to watch a movie, it's frustrating.
So Michael at 3 a.m. was on the right wavelength.
Yes.
For Ocean's 12.
100%.
Yeah.
Well, and I think too, a big part of that had to do with the passage of time, which was that they didn't expect Ocean's 11 to be the huge, enormous hit that it was necessarily. Like, obviously, they were packing it full of stars, but they weren't supposed to be three of them. You know what I'm saying? So, and the passage of time, these people, a lot of these actors and the franchise itself got bigger and bigger in reputation and sense of expectation and prestige. And I think that kind of weighted down some of that humor where it was like they really. So, for example, in Ocean's 11, the moment when Julia Roberts walks in is so late into the movie. And it's because it's true to the characters. It feels like that's organic to the story. It feels like that's when the character, you know, it's this reveal. They weren't able to do any of that for Ocean's 12 or 13. It was so, all of these expectations, all the studio, all the money that was being invested in it, they only got more expensive. People only got more famous. So they weren't able to do this like sort of playful thing with it. It had to be super on the nose.
Well, but kudos to Soderbergh, especially with 12, for saying, I just made a blockbuster movie and they want me to do a sequel. I'm going to make kind of a European art film out of
it. Sure. Right? I mean, yeah, there are things I really like about 12.
Yeah. And even though 13 takes place in Vegas, all three feel like very different movies, even though they have different writers, all three of them, but they have the same editor, cinematographer, director, cast, but they just feel like each movie has its own sort of voice in this trilogy that feels tied together.
Yeah, I agree.
That's what I do love about Soderbergh. I mean, I don't love all his movies, but I really appreciate just he really doesn't seem to care. You know, he's like, I'm going to make Ocean's 12, Ocean's 12. I love directors who are able to work in and out of the studio system and just do their thing. Mm-hmm. And I really respect that.
Something I love about his direction in Ocean's 11 is I love that it feels, I always thought, Ocean's 11 is kind of the Soderbergh doing a blockbuster movie.
Sure.
But then rewatching it, I noticed there's so many shots that feel like they are from The Sting or from some 60s spy film, these weird sort of harsh zooms or wide zooms and things like that. And so it sort of feels like a blockbuster movie and an art film and a throwback film all at the same time. It just manages that really well, which I just think is really impressive.
That scene where they're there for the demolition of the hotel. And everyone in the crowd is looking, like, turns to look at the hotel.
Right.
And then George Clooney and Matt Damon are still facing forward. That's straight, like, 60s, like, spy kind of stuff. That wide shot. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was paying attention. Like, there's so many, like, wipes and, like, split screens and just the editing.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much, like, character and fun happening. And so I was watching it, trying to kind of picture, like, how do you plan a movie like this, like
right.
this, because the style is so, you know, non-traditional. Like, how do you know, like, for sure the shot you want to dolly in and then zoom in really tightly onto this and only be on this while we're hearing this dialogue and then zoom back out? And there's just a lot of really cool choices that I think kind of all worked together to create this kind of like modern retro fun
it's got a lot of personality.
Like
watching it again, I was like, oh, he's doing a lot of interesting formal playful choices here, more than I remembered. And it just, yeah, I felt like, wow, you have a personality in this movie in every level, from the editing to the cinematography, even to like the weird like frame rate change for a minute when he's like chasing Matt Damon on the subway and like suddenly it's like slow shutter speed. It was really interesting. He's just kind of like, yeah, I'm gonna do that, why not?
Totally.
Well, you talk about the word cool, and I think this movie's a great example of it's cool because it's not trying to be cool. It's just cool people having a lot of fun, and that's kind of what makes it cool. It's sort of they're unafraid of just kind of being silly and having fun with each other, and that plays as cool so much more than if they said, let's make a really cool movie where we all look cool.
Yeah. Right. There's like a confidence in the silliness, you know, like Brad Pitt always eating, and you know, George Clooney is kind of silly in this movie.
Right.
You know, they're not trying to be super serious about anything. It's very goofy, actually, a lot of the time.
Or is it Ocean's 13 where they're watching Oprah? No, it's 12, I think, where they're watching Oprah and they start crying. George Clooney, Brad Pitt's in the couch, just the long shot of them watching, and then did he really get...
Yeah.
By the way, I feel like Brad Pitt always eating is another thing that just like stuck in my mind from this movie.
Uh-huh.
And like the like shape of like his facial structure while chewing, like I feel like I know it way too well
that
from this
jaw,
movie. Like I feel like there's like bones in his face that like I like are like seared in my brain because he's just chewing so much in this movie.
I feel like the way he like wipes his face
is
also kind of imprinted in my head.
Well, Brad Pitt's like...
Well, he has a tattoo on his hand in this movie, which also draws attention to when he's shoving food in his mouth.
Yeah. Brad Pitt is the king of holding things weird and pointing weird, you know?
Yeah.
He's carrying coffee, he's holding it with two fingers and the other fingers are spread out. and he's holding his whiskey and sort of putting
against
it up against
his forehead.
It's just, it's like every time, pick up a screwdriver. He's like, okay. And you're like, nobody's ever picked up a screwdriver like this.
Yeah.
I find myself holding my whiskey like that a lot when I'm just like.
I definitely did that after I saw that movie. Yeah.
But going back to what you guys were saying about some of the style choices, a lot of that originated in the script. Like a lot of those things of, you know, people talking over images of other things, or like we're seeing something that doesn't match up or that doesn't make sense to us or whatever. Some of that is just really clever editing, but some of that is in the script. The script is executed with so much confidence and swagger, which, you know, Ted Griffin again was saying, I think it was in the original Ocean's 11, although I don't remember that movie very well. And I also don't remember this interview that I am trying to reference very well, to be real. But he was saying he was drawn to characters who have a rapport with each other that almost have their own language.
Right.
And how much fun that is to watch and to try to almost decode or decipher the way that they're communicating, which obviously Danny and Rusty in this movie are
so amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. The way that they somehow telepathically communicate.
Right.
We should probably, And then we, yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And the scene where they're like, we could always, by tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. 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 That one really stood out to me this time watching it. Yeah.
Like I crack up every time with all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The other day, my dog looked at me funny and I said, what? You think we need one more? You think we need one more? All right, we'll get one more. And he just stared at me.
And I wondered if it, you know, I'd heard rumors that Brad Pitt and George Clooney were improvising their way through some of this. Mm. And there is that to a degree. But a lot of those most notable moments of just subtracted dialogue that communicates that effortlessness of this relationship, that's on the page. It provided a really, really good roadmap for Soderbergh, where he didn't have to sort of invent the wheel stylistically. It was on the page, a lot of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like the casting of all the characters, I feel like they all have that. Like, now that you've sort of said that, I'm, you know, Casey Affleck and Scott Caan?
Scott Caan.
Yeah. Them as,
you've,
like,
you've heard of
the
James Caan, right?
He was in that one
movie. He's in the mob movie.
A father and a something.
Yeah, you're close.
Yeah. But yeah, I feel like just, I think that is part of what kind of makes it so much fun to watch is, like, there is this, you can feel the connection that they all have. And Don Cheadle with his silly accent.
He tried.
Poor Don Cheadle.
I wonder how intentional the kind of weird accent was.
I think it was Don Cheadle trying really hard to do Cockney and doing a passable job, not a bad job. But...
At least the version of the script that I read, it didn't call for a Cockney
character. That was Cheadle.
Yeah, that was Don Cheadle. Yeah, okay. He decided the character should be Cockney in, you know, not a very moderately, no, very bad, not effective way.
I mean, Lock, Stock, and Snatch were more big at the, sure. Well, I guess, I don't know if Snatch had come out yet, but Lock, Stock was big. Because I think he was just trying to be one of those characters.
And in fairness, I like the decipher because the slang that he ends up going for does lend to that element of you want to decipher it. He's like, Barney Rubble, Trouble.
Trouble.
Yeah. That's a fun moment.
Yeah.
The execution, not successful.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was a little rough, but I appreciate, you know, I get what they're going for with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other thing that I love about this movie is how it works as a heist and the way, you know, the way the information is revealed about the heist. And I feel like it almost did it. Like, can you do it again? Like, I feel like Ocean's 11 just nails the, like, we know enough that we know what they're doing, but we also don't know what they're doing, so we want to know more. And
the payoff is so satisfying.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I do remember as however old I was, 12 or whatever, seeing it being very confused about what happened.
I'm actually still a little confused.
It is one of those movies where you kind of need a graph of just here's every single thing that happened.
Yeah. There's some logically, if you really do sit down to pull it all apart, there are some logical things where it's like, why did the briefcase with the explosives have to go in separately? Could Yen not have carried them in? Because we see he can tuck them into his thing. So why did he have to, and why did these have to happen simultaneously? Could we not have put the briefcase in a couple nights ago?
Right.
And definitely could have. Like,
if they knocked out all the power, would the power come back on that quickly? And would that have not screwed up more than this and that? But I feel like this is kind of connecting back to the kind of goofy, playful nature of it.
Yeah.
I think it creates this world where it isn't hyper real. So it's like, it's okay.
Right. You go with it. You go with it. Because it's like, this is a fun movie.
Right.
We're not to be overanalyzed.
Yeah.
And Ted Griffin did invent some of the rules about how Vegas works. And, you know, he said the whole thing about a casino has to have 10 times the amount of money or 3 times, whatever it is.
No, just every chip they play on the floor.
Yeah. And during the commentary, he said, I made that up. And Soderbergh said, really? He said, I've been telling people. I thought it was true. And he said, the reality of how the vaults, how the money is kept is really uninteresting. It's a lot of men with armored cars and Uzis just carrying the money straight out of the casino into somewhere else. And that's it. And it's not, so you had to kind of make this rule set. But in that rule set, you have to stay true to it. But I feel like Ocean's 11 is the kind of movie where, because it's fun and playful, you don't care if it's not airtight logic.
Look, there's an EMP at the center of this plan that we know is not real, does not exist.
And I was looking at just like the design of the EMP device this time.
It's like in water.
Right. Yeah. It's liquid. It's so goofy looking. Yeah. Yeah.
But, just go to the science place and get the EMP device.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. But yeah, just that, I think a lot of that goes back to they set out to design something that was cool, fictional.
Right.
And cool.
Right.
And so you really get that sense of, like, obviously casinos aren't like, we're only shown like the most expensive, most pristine, sort of very exclusive version of Vegas, which is, I don't know, I suppose possibly exists, but
I think probably it's accessible, you know, to certain people if they only, like,
well, actually, now that I think about it, I think I read that the main cast lived at the Bellagio.
Yeah.
They actually in like villas at the Bellagio.
So, yeah, there's probably a place for that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Clearly, I didn't know there were villas at the Bellagio, so I guess maybe this does exist. But
although I don't care what casino it is, if you're just on the main floor, there's a lot more people in Donald Duck t-shirts and shorts. And
right.
So
exactly.
Many flip-flops. And, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one thing, talking about the heist itself, watching it again, I realized, because I'd forgotten actually a lot of how it goes down. Mm. And there's a lot of times where you know, because the movie has not let you in on the entirety of the plan, you as the audience think it's going south. Like, this is going to be irretrievably bad. And then it reveals multiple times this is part of the plan. And I think that was just, I realized why this movie is such a joyful ride, mm-hmm. is that it gives you that roller coaster, you know, just continuously. It's like, oh, wow, this is, it's over. This is not, they're not going to recover from this. Oh, wait, that was part of it. Brad Pitt is the doctor. You know, like, it does that, like, I think, like, a few times.
Yeah.
Three or four.
Yeah, like serious moments where, like, you're pretty sure this is what it looks like for the heist to fail and is part of the plan. And it got me every time. It was just very impressive. And I think that's what is a good heist movie, is that you really do feel like things are not going to work out. And you realize it's a very clever part of the plan in a way you could never have imagined.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the most interesting things that it does, John Truby has his 22 steps to storytelling, which is like, it's very specific and exhausting. But it was really interesting to read that and go, so many of these things happen to the audience, not to the protagonist, because most movies are about a protagonist trying to overcome an obstacle.
Right.
Ocean's 11 is about a protagonist who already knows what's going on.
It goes pretty darn well.
Like if you look at Danny Ocean, he basically has no character arc, no plot arc or anything like that. He's just there, but we as the audience are being taken on this ride of the protagonist. There's a crisis moment that we are, you know, think is the crisis moment. There's all these moments that happen that we think happen, so we are being sort of taken on the journey of a movie, even though what's actually happening in real life isn't a lot of these things. And I think that's such an interesting approach to writing a screenplay.
Right, because it actually mostly goes according to plan for the characters.
Right.
It's us who are stressed out.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know, sort of the main audience surrogate, I guess, or we're put in a very similar position to Linus, really. Like, Linus is kind of the person that they choose to leave in the dark about a lot of things. Concealing information from other characters, like, it ends up sort of being contrived. Like, why do they have to lie to Linus? You know, and honestly, you know, Danny Ocean shrugs. Like, he's like, why can't you just tell me things? And he's like, what?
But like, also,
because you're the audience, Linus. Like, basically.
But I also love that it, like, just sets up this trend of, like, kind of, like, teasing Matt Damon. Like, that is one of the parts of Ocean's 12 I like, where they just, like, mess with Matt Damon. I don't know. Anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
You have to have a rookie.
Yeah.
I mean, he's that rookie character that they're kind of going to josh him, you know, and whatever. So you buy it in that sense. But it really is just the movie actively lies to the audience. Mm-hmm, it's not even just that they don't tell us something. It's that they're lying to us. The scene where Carl Reiner Saul goes to get up and he like sort of staggers back and he's by himself in his room.
Okay, hang on.
Okay.
But he could be actually nervous. He could actually be.
Well, the movie establishes that Saul actually does have health problems.
That's true. But all of that is lying in the sense that, or it's bluffing, right? In the sense that they're
like
trying.
Like a poker game.
Almost like a poker game.
It's bluffing.
Well, yeah, but they specifically give Saul health problems and show them to us, even when he sometimes is trying to hide them from other characters, so that moment is imbued with some sense of stakes and real desperation.
Right, but that's not lying. That's setting up a red herring.
It's on the border. I think it's kind of on the border because it's like,
I'm not mad at the movie for lying. Right. I think it lies very effectively.
It kind of goes back to the Hitchcock quote that maybe I made up. Because there's not,
no one can find
there's it. Currently no evidence that he ever said this, but young Michael remembers watching a behind the scenes, like, this is history of movies and Psycho and blah, blah, blah. And I remember Hitchcock saying something to the effect of, never trick your audience, let your audience trick themselves. And I feel like I like that as a defining that kind of gray area where it's like, we're not, the movie isn't purposely it is purposely misleading us, but not in a way that we couldn't like figure out what the truth is. And there's like this like little like wiggle room there where I feel like you can't overtly lie to the audience, but you can set it up to be like, look, you're gonna think this to set up the proper reveal.
Mom, I want to be a screenwriter. This Hitchcock guy really knows his stuff.
is that your Young Michael impression?
Yeah, I think it's the Young Michael, Wow.
Voice just constantly cracking. Yeah. Just cracking 24/7.
What do I even sound like? Oh boy. No.
But that, to me, that's the most egregious moment is the one where, because as long as other people are in the room, you buy that the characters are sort of performing for each other. And that it allows you to have that moment where Linus is like, why are you messing with me? And he's like, oh, it's fun. That lovely, amazing moment where Rusty's giving Linus advice and he's like, don't do this. Look up, you know, they know you're lying. Look down, they know you don't know the truth. Like that whole thing. And then he gets called away.
He says, and the most important thing, don't ever. What? Okay.
Right. Yeah. All of those I buy as long as characters are interacting with each other. But the moment where Saul gets up, staggers back, and Rusty is like ducking behind the door frame because he's worried or whatever. He doesn't want Saul to know that he saw Saul in a moment of weakness. That to me is the most like, this movie lies. It lies.
It's not lying.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of agree with you. I think it's fine in Ocean's 11. I'm totally down with it.
Sure.
But I do think, it does bother me in movies when a character is alone and they do something that is like revealed later to be like the fake thing.
Right.
They did it by themselves with nobody watching.
Right.
Yeah, it does happen once in a while. Yeah.
Or this is similar, but the Hobbit trilogy, which just to get
just like Ocean's 11,
just like just to get Ian Holm and Elijah Wood in the movie, they bookend the trilogy as him telling Frodo a story. Bilbo is telling Frodo the story of, let me tell you what happened when I was young. Which would be fine if the Hobbit trilogy didn't multiple times go off and follow other characters around.
Right.
Like, here's the conversation the bad guys are having with each other about what they're going to go do. And I'm thinking, well, is this framed as Bilbo telling Frodo a story or not? Because you kind of can't have it both ways. You can't have this omniscient point of view and then frame it as a character saying, this is an experience I had.
You mean the Hobbit movies
like, aren't perfect?
Are flawed?
We can go into that another time. But but
they don't make sense? What?
That was a specific thing. I think that's one thing that you can't be subjective about. Like, that just objectively doesn't make sense, as opposed to a lot of things with the Hobbit movies where we might think they're bad, but maybe not everyone agrees.
Yeah.
But I think that's like a good kind of standard, like you were saying, Alex. Like, if someone is alone and they're keeping up a performance, like, that doesn't make sense. I feel like that's cheating.
Right.
Which squarely put into the lie.
Trisha, you brought up about Mark Ruffalo in Now You See Me. And that's why I think it's not lying with Ocean's 11 with Saul, because he genuinely does have health problems. So it's tricking the audience. It's saying, we're going to give this guy health problems, and
he also happens to have a health problem in the
plan. So it's absolutely messing with the audience. It's tricking the audience, but it's not lying to
them. As bad as Mark Ruffalo alone. And
exactly.
Could he have been practicing how he's going to look sick later?
That's what Trisha said.
Yeah. I do think there's an extent that we see that Saul is kind of a method actor. Right?
Because
there is that moment where he's doing his accent, his Lyman Zerga accent.
My name is Lyman Zerga.
Yeah. But we see they're just lounging around in the hotel room and somebody goes, Saul, turn that off. And he goes, I'll turn it off when I'm ready to turn it off. He's doing his accent. So they do give you that hint that he's also just a method actor. So they kind of create that sense of like, he might act this way when he's alone to stay in character.
Yeah. So maybe it actually is, and totally like,
later,
not cheating at all.
When they're in, it's like revealing that he's like one of the SWAT team and he's in the elevator. It like cuts to him and he's like having a hard time breathing. So I feel like it does kind of, you know, they're showing, look, he has health problems still.
He just wasn't dying right there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
They're like, just enough wiggle room, I feel like, to maybe.
I will say, Carl Reiner can do anything, and I'm happy about it. Oh, he's such a delight.
He's so good in this movie, too. I mean, everyone is, but.
So speaking of, like, the SWAT team thing, and I don't know if we want to go too deep into this, but, like, I am still a little confused about like what's happening, where and when. They have a video of them like with half the money, and that's the fake video of them in the vaults with like masks on, moving around half of the money, lying, saying that the rest of the money is already gone in a van. And the reality is they're just sitting in the vaults on all of the money, waiting for the fake SWAT team to arrive.
You've got it.
Yeah. And okay. And yeah. Okay. And then the SWAT team has a bunch of bags with them that nobody notices. But
right. Well, they're SWAT bags.
The SWAT bags. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's their lunches.
You know how the SWAT team.
And when they call
911,
it like doesn't go to 911. Like,
right. It goes to Livingston.
It goes to Livingston. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I do feel like the one sequence where I think it becomes really confusing is where Rusty's on the phone with Benedict saying, this is what's going to happen. And it kind of sounds like, and it kind of plays to me anyway, that like, this is what's going to happen. This isn't what's happening right now.
Right.
But like, this is what we want to happen. We're setting up the events that are going to transpire. But then at the end of the call, it's like, oh, I guess that actually did just transpire. And I feel like that's the only part
it's
that kind of disconnects
problem.
For me.
Well, and I think part of the problem for me is that like, the confusion was, when did the, in like in their fake story of like only half the money is still in the vault, like there's no explanation of how the other half of the money got out into the white van. Like,
yeah, no, yes, there is.
Is there?
Yes. Casino personnel carry it up because Rusty tells Benedict that they have to send armed guards. They're going to load the bags into the elevator. Mm-hmm. The guards are going to come pick the bags up. The casino personnel are going to load them into the back of the white van.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's how they get up there. And then they drive the van to the airport and it's a remote control and bloody blah.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It happens.
I always just get mixed up during that part.
But it is a logical time problem, though, because at the end of the call, Benedict gives his like run and hide asshole speech. And then we see that the phone is already down and they've already gone. And so it's like,
right.
When did the bags get?
Right. I think that's why my brain couldn't understand like when
like,
it
how
all
long
happened.
Were they on the phone? Because then he goes, I have complied with your every request.
Right. It's like, when did that happen?
When? Just now while we were just chit-chatting? I like to imagine that Benedict and Rusty were just on the phone silently for like 10 minutes while that was happening. Just like, you still there? Yep. Just waiting.
It's the old movie trope of someone starting a conversation and then it cuts to a different location and they're having the next line of
the next line of the conversation. Seriously.
I also like how it dates the movie when Julie Roberts says, I don't have a cell phone.
Oh, yeah. It's an insane moment.
I do not have a cell phone.
What does that mean? Yeah. One of the things I love about the heist sequence is how it jumps between perspectives and how Benedict kind of becomes a character that we are with when the heist is actually happening.
Yes. Right.
And kind of the way they just kind of feather him in, where like you just see him on the periphery earlier on and then you kind of get to know him better in that scene with George Clooney and Julia Roberts where he comes and interrupts. It's kind of cool how they kind of build him up to be a character so that then when the heist is happening, we can jump to his perspective and experience it from his perspective.
Yeah, I think who's the best character to use to hide information from the audience? It's Linus, because he's the only person on the team who they don't trust, and there's a reason they're hiding information from him. Then later, who's the best character to reveal information to the audience? It's Benedict, because everyone else knows what's going on at this point, except for Benedict. So as he figures it out, we figure it out with him. So it's a cool shifting of perspectives there.
It's very elegant the way that this is put together, because as you guys were pointing out, it is essentially an omniscient POV, but it's so selective in the way that it jumps, it like bestows knowledge on different characters from moment to moment, that it's just so effective. The way that the reveals are ordered is really important as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the one that I always come back to as just like, not a bad idea, but reveals in the wrong order is the village.
Oh, right.
It's like there are like three or four secrets, right, in that movie or something. Like, one of them is like John Hurt knows about the monsters. Then it's like the monsters aren't real,
John Hurt's in the village.
Who am I thinking of? That is John Hurt, isn't it? Am I crazy?
I think so.
William Hurt.
There
we go.
Sorry. Yeah.
It was something hurt.
Yeah.
William Hurt. Yeah. So, but the reveals are in such a way that it robs all of the like tension out from under the climax where she has to face off with that creature in the woods. Because by that point, we know the creature isn't real, even though she doesn't know that. But it's like,
We do, so we whatever.
We do, yeah.
I remember there was some laughter in the theater during that scene. It was really sad.
I specifically remember my friend and I laughing out loud when the credits rolled. And we're not those guys. Like, we weren't doing it to be jerks. We just both actually laughed because we were like, that was so dumb.
Well, I think it was like the part where she's like, I killed the monster. Like, when she gets back to the, like...
Oh, man.
The room at the end. Yeah. And, like, the parents in the background are like, oh, no. It's like, people are, like, laughing.
Yeah. It definitely doesn't work. But here...
It's, like, sad and, you know, it's, like, very sad. But, like, it was unfortunate how it played as, like, almost humorous.
Yeah, but here, they do such a nice job where knowing that Danny is still in it doesn't rob anything out from underneath of Saul's collapse, which doesn't rob anything out from underneath the bank heist itself, which doesn't, you know, like they are so well ordered, like a row of dominoes, that you still have a million questions even after each reveal. And that's why the movie is able to trick you so many different times.
Right.
Because you're like, well, they were lying about this thing, but I still believe this other thing is true.
Right.
Right. And they set those up really, really well. And then they just like tip them on down.
I was impressed by upon this viewing, how much I had forgotten and how much it tricked me all over again. Every single one, I was like, oh, you got me.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Mm. Yeah.
Thinking about the different perspectives made me jump back to kind of the beginning of the movie where we're meeting the 11 people and just how much fun that is. And I feel like they very efficiently established, like, this is what these characters are. And like, these two brothers are actually just this one character and they'll only ever exist in the same scenes together. But it just, I feel like it does all the heist things so well, where like the first half is all the like setup and let's meet the people. And then midpoint is like Julia Roberts comes in and everything is more complicated. But yeah, I really appreciate how much fun that is. And I feel like it's this thing that movies do a lot where they try to have like fun intro character sequences, but like it feels like forced in some ways. And I think this one just feels so like fun and effortless, and like the way like, you know, one kind of connects to the other where they're scoping out one person while they're talking about the next person in the background, you see things happening. It's just a very well executed sequence of doing that.
Well, you mentioned Julia Roberts coming in and complicating everything, and that's what's so enjoyable about this movie for me, because I sometimes get a little bored of just, you know, it's going to be a super cool heist movie, like, you're going to be very clever and all that, and I'm down for that. But it's so much fun when a new element's added that you did not expect, which is the Julia Roberts element. And it's broadcasted at the beginning of the film. You know, first scene, he's talking about his wife left him. But it's just, once she comes in and there's all that tension and the great first dialogue scene between her and George Clooney, I'm by the movie.
That seemed amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a good scene. Yeah.
And Ted Griffin talked about, he said he loves the idea of movies where you don't realize until the end why this character was doing it, what he was doing.
Right.
He actually mentioned The Straight Story, the David Lynch movie, where like the old man drives across the country on a tractor or lawnmower to visit his brother. And he said, it just inspired me of the end. You go, oh, okay, now I sort of understand what this was all about. And he actually said he was about halfway through the script before he even realized the movie was actually about Danny and Tess and not just about running a fun, which is interesting because it feels like that is the heart of the
that's
movie.
Why it's special. You know?
Exactly.
And that's really the final reveal that is so satisfying.
Right. Yeah. But also, what a great lesson that he was halfway through the script before he realized that's what the movie was.
The screenwriting process is a long and winding one.
Yeah. Well, but going back to what you were saying about character introductions, this movie is so good because it gives time to the ones that need time, and then like sort of, you know, fast forwards through some of the ones that we can just get a little bit more quickly and easily. So obviously the intro, the opening shot of the movie, where it starts on this empty chair, it gives you this feeling of like waiting. You want to know who this person is that's going to come in and fill this chair. And they create that like even brief moment of suspense where it's just like, who's going to walk in here? And in walks George Clooney, which is already like a power move to open your movie. And then he sits down and says his name, like, and then starts going into this, speech basically, where he's not trying to impress the parole board, really. Like, he is so composed. He doesn't feel nervous about getting out, but he's tricky. There's a lot of subtext there. We see the whole thing. He's introducing himself, but in a way that doesn't feel trite or, like, too honest or overly explaining. We can tell he has secrets. it's so good. And it's such a smart choice on Soderbergh's part not to cut away from him, because in the script they do, they cut to the parole board.
They shot that too.
I'm sure they did. Yeah. It's just really, really smart editing. And then think too, like, how long is that intro scene with Rusty? It's long. Mm. It's a whole big long scene where we get to know who Rusty is. Same thing with Benedict. They spend a ton of time setting Benedict up even before we meet him. Mm-hmm. And then when we meet him, this like Damon's speech about Linus's speech about this guy's a machine. He does this and this and this. He remembers every valet's name on the way in. Like, he speaks four languages, all of that stuff. It's just,
what a fun sequence. I love that sequence.
Yeah. And then they spend more time on Saul as well. So like the bigger players, you spend the time on those guys. You don't need as much time with the Malloy brothers or with Livingston. Even so, those are really effectively written, but they're nice and short. It's a really, the allocation of time on character intros for a movie that has so many characters.
Yeah, definitely.
Really, really smart.
Because it could be a problem if they felt like they had to kind of equalize the time between all these characters, which, that would not be good.
Yeah.
Soderbergh, really unfocused.
Yeah. Soderbergh was saying on the commentary that he tried to make sure everyone showed up enough. So if you need a character to walk across the screen, well, we haven't seen Livingston in a while, let's make him do it. But he, I think it was Ted Griffin who said he sort of felt like there were these four stories going on, which was Danny getting back Tess, Rusty kind of taking charge, Linus getting up to the task, and Saul going on one last adventure, basically. And it's like the other characters don't have important character arcs. You need to represent them, but you don't need, like you said, Trisha, you don't need to shove every, like, a D and an F and a G, you know, like a bunch of stories that they're all doing some big thing. Also, I want just a montage of Andy Garcia walking like he has a stick up himself.
Like, so fascinating the way
things to do in Denver when you're dead. Godfather 3, the Ocean's movie, like every, he's always walking, always
Andy Garcia,
in a nice suit walking along.
I love his physicality in this, how just sort of like upright he is, and like you were talking about, like, uptight, really, but so purposeful and driven. Like, he really embodies, because he has to, right? He has to be like a formidable enemy. And so he has to embody that just by walking on screen, basically. And he does it so well. The white suit jacket is like the power move there. But.
Right.
Watching at this time, kind of going back to the love story between Danny and Tess, I feel like the actors also did a ton of work.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because I don't know that it makes any sense for Tess to be in love with Danny or Benedict.
Right.
Just thinking about it kind of like, objectively, she was with Danny, didn't know he was a con man. He got arrested, went away for 5 years. And then after he pulls a con on her current boyfriend, now she realizes she loves him.
See, I always thought she knew he was a con man for like a long time. I think she was, I honestly thought she left him because he got caught, not because he was a con man. Like, because she was saying, I had to get away from, you know, I had to leave New York to get away from what happened. But not that there's, I don't think there's like a moral problem with him being a con artist. It was just, he like sort of destroyed their reputations by getting caught.
Yeah. I think my own personal headcanon is just basically, you know, they genuinely had a great relationship and they had issues and it was tumultuous and it fell through. And then now she's dating a guy who's fine and she doesn't maybe realize some of his darker qualities. So she's sort of casually dating Benedict almost, where you can see her sort of frustrated with their relationship. But even though the script never tells you, I just, because that's how movies are, I just assume, oh, they're in love. Like, they really wish they were together, but they just have.
But that's where it does. Sorry. It does help that it's George Clooney and Julia Roberts, because like, you feel the chemistry.
Right.
And like, when he leans in to give her like a kiss on the cheek, it's just like, you can't deny that. And so it just fills in all the blanks right there.
Yeah. I feel like it was just like one of those moments where, like, if I was just looking at objectively the things on the page, I'd be like, wait, question mark. And also, she moved from New York and then moved to Vegas and then dated the most rich man.
Right.
Like,
Vegas?
You're doing pretty well. I don't know.
Well, see, I always thought that he.
You're finding people impressively. Continue.
I mean, she is Julia Roberts, so if anybody can find the richest man in Vegas and somehow get with him, I mean, probably.
She's just a girl standing in a casino.
Well, yeah. I like the sort of part about her being an artist and an art collector. I think it gives the character some dimension, but I also think it's designed to be kind of an image of she herself is being collected in a way. It doesn't feel like Benedict cares about her as a person, except as she's like brilliant and beautiful, and she's just sort of there to be on his arm, right? And which is what we see in that moment. I don't know if it's enough to be like, she's going to leave him forever, but we see in that moment where he's willing to give her up in the sense that he feels like he has the ability to do that or the right to do that as though she's a piece of property.
Right.
And so that sort of is the premise that she has been. He's a rich and powerful man who has just sort of picked her up because she was a beautiful object.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I still feel like my favorite Julia Roberts performance, though, is when she's playing not Julia Roberts in Ocean's 12.
Oh, she's playing Tess?
Yeah, I'm just, as you were like talking about that, I was just picturing her like with Bruce Willis pretending to be friends with Bruce Willis.
Yeah, I don't know.
When she gets like so Ocean's excited. 12. When Bruce Willis walks in the room and she's like, again. Oh my God.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Well, he was all supposed to be in this movie too, wasn't he?
He was supposed to be Danny.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, Bruce Willis was supposed to be Danny. Oh,
interesting.
And the Owen and Luke Wilson were supposed to be mm-hmm. the Malloy brothers.
Oh, that could have been fun.
Which I always remember thinking, I just wish Ben Affleck played Turk Malloy because you already got Damon and right. Casey, and I was just like, oh, that would have been perfect. Obviously, Scott Conn is fine; it's great, but I just thought that would be really fun to just be like, let's get the old gang back together.
Yeah. I mean, and it did start to feel like as in 12 and 13 they just started honestly kind of throwing any actor at it that they were like, you know who we could probably get,
yeah,
let's get that person in here. So they just kind of started doing that. But it is interesting how this movie just sort of has become a landmark for the heist genre, really. Mm-hmm. Like wanting to make sure that we say, like, they may, you know, there have been a lot of heist movies since Ocean's 11 and none of them have been Ocean's 11 truly.
Right.
Like, think about, even not, no shade or not too much shade on the sequels, but just think about something like the new, not new anymore, but like they made The Italian Job right after this. Mm-hmm. And then they made like a few other sort of slick heisty movie kind of things. National Treasure, I guess we could put into that box. It was
overlapping Venn diagram.
Kind of. Although I think some of the heisty bits of National Treasure are maybe the best bits in it. Mm. But yeah, it really sort of created this new revival of like heist kind of thing, and there is nothing that works as well as this. It all feels too contrived. Or let's go back to Now You See Me. That is trading directly on prestige from Ocean's 11. Like, let's get a bunch of magicians. Wouldn't they be great people to pull off a heist?
Right.
And it doesn't work at all. And they try to hide information from the audience, and they do it in such a way that ends up making it ineffective completely. Mm-hmm. So not that it didn't make its money, because I'm sure it did.
It's also just that
a sequel, so.
Yeah.
There's also the lightning in a bottle magic of just like these actors this time.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you can't replicate that. It's just what it was.
Yeah, it really is just total A list all around, which is really cool.
Yeah. And Soderbergh came right off of Traffic and Aaron Brockovich to make this movie.
Right.
Just respect. Like, picked up this script and really, really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ocean's 11 is special.
I also like that there are no guns in the entire trilogy, to the point where at the end of 13, when the Night Fox pulls a gun on Matt Damon and he goes, a gun? You know? And I like it because it's almost this meta thing of just saying, like, didn't you read the handbook? Like, this is not how we in this community operate, and that's really not cool.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really impressive.
Yeah. There is this sort of honor among thieves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very, you know, unrealistic thing where, and Soderbergh has said, this is my only movie where like nobody gets hurt, basically. Not just physically hurt, but like the only people who get like hurt, Benedict. Why? Because he lost a lot of money.
Right.
Like,
he's still fine,
still super fine. Yeah, no one really gets hurt in this movie. And thinking about how, instead of, it doesn't mean that there aren't stakes just because someone's not pointing a gun at somebody. And I think that there were a few like down and dirty heist movies after this that tried to make it about that, where it's like someone's gonna die, or like, you don't need that, at least not if you're in this very stylized, very clean, very stylized, very wealthy world. You know, people, rich people don't shoot each other, they write checks.
Yeah,
truth.
That's also interesting that it was 2001
and like, yeah.
And a more innocent time in the world.
Right.
Right. Like,
in a lot of ways, which I think is partially why it was able to be the special thing that it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was early aughts when they made The Bank Job with Jason Statham, which is a heist gone wrong movie. And to my recollection, I have not seen it recently, so this might or might not be a spoiler, but to my recollection, like, everybody dies. Mm. Like, the heist goes so bad and everybody dies. No, it isn't. But that was like, 3 years later, it makes total sense given the state of the world, how quickly fun in Vegas went straight to now
everybody
we're all gonna
dies.
Die. Yeah. So, but I actually do, I do want to say I liked Logan Lucky, which is, you know, Soderbergh trying to return and make another heist movie. It's not Ocean's 11, but there's a thing he sees in heist movies that he's able to extract and execute really, really well. So
I find Soderbergh to be one of those fascinating directors where you just are never sure what he's going to do.
Yeah.
And it's kind of exciting, but I think it's also kept me from ever being totally on board the Soderbergh train just because I don't know what the, you know,
there's not a consistency. It's all over the place.
Right.
Yeah. Sort of like Danny Boyle in that way.
Yeah.
We're like, what are you making next, Danny Boyle? I don't understand.
But I'm on the Danny Boyle train.
No, same.
I've loved enough Danny Boyle to be like, I'm here for whatever you do next. Soderbergh, I'm like, I'm really curious what you're doing next. But
Well, he has a movie coming out next year.
Mm-hmm. The Netflix movie.
Yeah. Very excited. We'll let you know how it is.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. It's Trisha. Just wanted to take a quick moment and thank you all for listening to Beyond the Screenplay. If you like the podcast as much as we like making it for you, we would really love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want, it would help us out a lot if you could support us on Patreon. For just $2 a month, patrons get extra content like mini episodes and Q&As, and it's a pretty cheap price and it really, really helps us a lot. So thanks and back to the episode.
Well, why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take away from Ocean's 11? Alex, do you want to start?
Sure. We kind of touched on this before, but the setup of Terry Benedict and just how formidable an opponent he is, it's just always a good lesson for me of, you know, he is very smart. He's actually kind of paranoid. He's always like one step ahead of you. You feel when he's talking to these characters, he's onto them constantly, and he's noticing details that are going to maybe, you know, give up the plan. So I think just always the lesson of make your antagonist like the hardest possible antagonist for the task at hand. And he's perfect for that. And Andy Garcia plays him perfectly. And so, yeah, that's my lesson.
Nice.
Yeah. Trisha?
I really love how this movie relies on silence and like sort of what we were talking about, the characters speaking their own language, and then how that doesn't always necessarily have to look like dialogue even.
Mm-hmm.
I love this, the scene near the beginning, and it's in the script written just like this, where Rusty goes, "You want to knock over a casino?" And Danny just holds up three fingers. He shakes his head and holds up three fingers, which the performance is amazing. But that's
and then Brad Pitt starts to take his next drink and then stops.
Exactly. He like stuffs this teacup halfway to his mouth. But that is what a brilliant moment to use to establish the relationship between these two characters and how like in that poker scene, their mouths are just sort of twitching and their eyes are just kind of sparkling at each other.
So much bromance.
It's really beautiful. Listen, if anyone ever understood me as well as Danny and Rusty understand each other.
Right. It's very beautiful.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
The script says Danny's eyes sparkle.
At Rusty. No, but just sometimes that looks like banter and we see that between the two of them. Sometimes that looks like silence. And two, you know, sometimes thinking about Danny and Tess, how all of their rapport is dialogue, but it is still sort of its own language, how they fire back and forth. Just thinking about how you can deepen a world or deepen like the relationship between characters. It doesn't have to be stilted. It doesn't have to be honest. It just has to be something organic that exists between the two of them. And it doesn't have to be words. You can just let the characters look at each other or gesture or whatever.
Yeah. Awesome. Brian?
I actually want to talk about my lessons for Ocean's 11 by also talking about how Ocean's 12 and 13 do or don't do the same thing, which is I'm looking at the emotional through line of the movie and also the informational through line, like how information is delivered to the audience, and that very difficult balance between we're hiding information, but also the information we hid from you doesn't feel like cheating. It feels like, oh, okay, I knew enough of that to, and I think Ocean's 11 does it really well, where the emotionality builds as Tess is introduced, and then there's more scenes between Danny and Tess, and it gets more and more, oh, that's what this movie is actually about, as the information is also being delivered to the audience. Ocean's 12, I remember seeing it with a friend. I think I'd already seen it once, then I went and saw it with him. And I said, what do you think? What did you think? And he said, I don't like a movie where there's no way I could have figured anything out during the movie. And I think Ocean's 12 sort of hides so much information from you that at the end you're like, okay, fine. And also the emotional moment in that movie doesn't happen until the end. You don't even realize that Isabel's father is Lamarck and he's still alive, right, and blah, blah, blah. So it's a really lovely moment, but it doesn't feel earned because it wasn't something you had been waiting for. It's just something that sort of shows up. Ocean's 13, with the way it handles information, there's less trickery in that movie. There's fewer surprises in that. So it handles the information fine. You're like, okay, everything I was watching was real, but also there was some other stuff going on behind the scenes. Fine. But the emotional through line is great at the beginning. I love that it's Saul has his, has his heart attack, and then they're going after, they say, we're going to go after Willie Bank for this, and blah, blah, blah. And you feel great. It's a revenge movie and it's personal. And then that kind of gets lost throughout the movie. Like they come back to it, but it doesn't. And it pays off at the end, but it feels like you've, as opposed to Ocean's 11, where it keeps building, in Ocean's 13, it sort of sucks you in at the beginning, and then it kind of stops being about that anymore. So I think that it's just interesting to follow those two things and how the different movies handle it. And I think you can sort of see, using just those two pieces, why Ocean's 11 is as strong as it is, and why the other two movies are fine, but not quite as powerful in delivering those two elements.
And we have been trying to crack the code of, what is the rule, right? Like, what is the formula? When do you show it? When do you not? When do you hint at it? How much do you hint at it? We've pulled Ocean's 11 all the way apart looking for that formula, and I'm not sure there is one.
It's really hard to find this, but I think about this when I play video games, like puzzle video games, which is, I want to solve a puzzle and go, oh, okay, that I didn't realize that thing was there. And I think it's the Zelda games and the Resident Evil games I remember playing as a teenager, and I couldn't figure it out, and I would look it up online and I would go, what? Yeah. I had to go find the top hat and stick it on the other thing. Yeah. What are you talking about? And I think that's really what I think about when I think about how movies control information, is I want to go, oh, and not, come on, that doesn't make any sense. You didn't give me any. And how you do that objectively, like what that line, who knows? But it's just trying to elicit that response from the audience and not the other.
Right.
I feel like it's what you're saying, puzzle design, which I feel like you could study puzzle design probably for your whole life.
Escape rooms are kind of an interesting example of that right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like the potentially fictional Hitchcock that young Michael watched, he knew how to do it.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
This guy's a genius.
Pretty sure that's not how I sounded, but I'm okay with it. Yeah, so I think for me, the lesson I took away from revisiting Ocean's 11 was kind of like I said earlier, the importance of perspective and how to use perspective to reveal the information. In my writing, I tend to very much like stick with one perspective. Like there's this one protagonist and the entire story is usually told from, they're in every scene and they're only seeing what the protagonist sees. And I have trouble sometimes like jumping out and remembering their other modes of storytelling. And I think seeing how Ocean's 11 uses that, you know, omniscient point of view, and how you can use that and be selective and create like fun moments that couldn't happen in any other way. Mm. I think that was like a nice refresher and a kind of a push to me to like think about telling stories differently than I default to. So, yeah.
But also not just switching perspective arbitrarily.
Right. Yes.
All exactly. Very skillfully.
You're right. Yeah. Intentionally doing it for the most impact for the audience that also makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those things. Well, let's quickly say what we've been watching recently. Trisha, you want to start us off?
Sure. I recently got a chance to watch the movie The Souvenir, which just came out. It is by a British director named Joanna Hogg, and it stars Honor Swinton Byrne, who is Tilda Swinton's daughter.
What?
Yeah. Oh. And she, as you can imagine, has a really interesting face. And no, she's like, it's one of those things where it's that actor who you can't look away from kind of thing, because you're just like, you look fascinating. Mm. She looks fascinating. She is really talented. And the movie is set in the 80s, and it's about a real life young filmmaker played by Honor in this movie, who fell in love with like a much older, almost like a film professor of hers. But he has like a drug problem, and like it becomes this really like abusive relationship. And the actor who plays that character is Tom Burke. And then obviously Tilda Swinton is also in it playing her own daughter's mother. she's playing herself, I guess, in a way, but a character. Yeah. It's really interesting. Huh. It's sort of one of those stories where it's painful to watch because you're just seeing like a young person who thinks that they know, they think they're in control of their life. They think they're making their own decisions and they're just caught in this loop. And so it's sort of hard to watch, but it's lovely and elegant and really well directed. So recommend.
Hmm. Well, name again?
The Souvenir.
Awesome. Brian, what have you been watching?
I went to my favorite theater in Los Angeles again to see a 35mm screening of Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Which I had not seen in over 15 years. So it was really fresh to me. I remember the broad strokes, but I didn't remember the actual individual scenes.
Yeah.
And it's such a good movie. And I just think Billy Wilder is one of those people who 50 years later, his films feel so fresh and relevant, and it makes me wonder, was he just that ahead of his time, or did just Hollywood decide we need to make more movies like Billy Wilder and sort
this
of
this is how we make movies
yeah
now.
Exactly. But I just think it's such a good example of a movie that is just really funny and entertaining and engaging, but also takes dark turns in a way that feel sort of heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. and earned, and it really plays with your emotions in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's awesome.
So good.
Yeah. I should really revisit it because mm-hmm. I also haven't seen it in a very long
it's
time.
It's haunting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool.
The only thing I'll say is Gloria Swanson's performance, which is incredible.
Yeah.
In 2019, it's like, I would really love to see the 90% version of that, you know, just like maybe take it down. But it's also fascinating to watch a character who the character thinks they're performing.
Right. Of
so
course,
I think that
yeah.
So it's you can get away with a little bit more of an over the top performance when the character you're playing is trying to give a performance.
Yeah, and from a different era of yeah, like acting
of
theory.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Alex.
So I recently, for the first time, watched The Thin Red Line,
yeah.
which had been on my like to-watch list forever. And I watched it on my big 4K TV with like
wow.
with headphones on for like full immersion. And I'm so happy I did because
yeah.
it is, you know, basically I realized I've only seen, now that I've seen that one, I've only seen 3 Terrence Malick films.
Whoa.
And I'm a huge fan, so it's weird I haven't seen more. But I love the new world. Mm-hmm. I appreciate Tree of Life. I never fell in love with Tree of Life, but Thin Red Line was up there for me along with New World as far as just wow, what a cinematic experience, where I feel like I've never seen a war movie that
yeah.
put me in like the emotional, sensory, almost like surreal headspace of being in, you know, at one time you're in this beautiful tropical environment.
Mm-hmm.
This comes idyllic paradise. You're just a normal person because you've been drafted into this war along with other very normal people who aren't like hardened soldiers. And then you're being given insane orders by some remote general to go like charge into machine gun fire, and just the complete surrealness of it all.
Yeah.
And the beauty of it and I just love how Terrence Malick doesn't have a cynical bone in his body. You know, he is just the most heartfelt, almost embarrassingly genuine filmmaker with these characters that are just kind of bearing their souls. And you know, Jim Caviezel, his eyes in this movie,
mm-hmm.
I can tell why Mel Gibson wanted him to be Jesus. You know, like there's just so much in this movie that touched me so deeply. And I would just highly recommend it if you're down for a meditative, reflective,
long.
3-hour yeah. 3-hour experience. And I'm also just a big nature lover. I like just being,
oh, yeah.
being soaking in nature, and that's basically what his movies are.
Oh yeah.
I know that I watched Patrick Willem's video recently on Terrence Malick's filmography.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of almost dissuaded me from watching some of Terrence Malick's more recent films.
Yeah, because, I've tried to watch them all.
Yeah. What
song
are your
to song is quite difficult to get through. And they just I think there's something about the situations that he gravitated towards, like Badlands, for example. Mm-hmm. Have you seen? No, you haven't.
I haven't. I need to see that in
None
Days of
you
Heaven.
Have you? Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Days of Heaven. Like
yeah.
when he's choosing material like that, that is about nature, is about like these large existential questions. So like
right.
think about Tree of Life, where there's this death in the family and war and like growing up in this really tumultuous time and stuff like that. He's at his best when he's grappling with that.
Right.
Not when he's like, here's some musicians in Austin. You're like, what?
Right.
What?
Yeah, the sense I even got from like the trailers for his more recent films felt a little more self-indulgent, a little bit less grappling with like these eternal themes.
Right. Yeah. Or just like a little bit harder to relate to. So right. Even the one that was set in Hollywood, what was that one with Christian Bale? Like
Knight of Cups.
Knight of Cups. Yeah. There you go. I watched that one. Yeah, that one also still feels like I'm not really sure that this marriage of material and filmmaker is going to like draw out some of the magic that you get from some of his right. earlier movies.
I honestly think it's the history part
yeah.
is what I love about his movies, because you know The New World, for example, yeah. is a very romanticized version of the Pocahontas story. There's mm-hmm. there's some issues there, but there is also just the full immersion
yeah.
into what it would feel like in this time, in this place, in this moment. I don't have any other filmmaker that gives me that like full immersion experience with these moments in time. So anyway, I'm a fan. Check it out.
Awesome. I recently finished the latest season of Big Little Lies, which was interesting. I felt like I learned a lot about, you know, kind of the situation around Big Little Lies, where the first season was really good and it ended and it wasn't ever supposed to have another season because it was based on a book. And then they were like, this was fun. We're going to do it again now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like watching this new season, there were times where I could really feel that, like the strain, and I'm probably projecting, but the strain of the screenwriters having to come up with another
yeah.
7 or 8 episodes, whatever it was, worth of content. And I think it was such an interesting example to watch with that mindset, because there's some things that they do really well. Like I think they created a really interesting antagonist. They also had Meryl Streep play her, which helps a lot.
So good.
I love that character.
But
like they created the antagonist has moments where you really understand where she's coming from and you're like, oh, maybe she's right. Like they introduced a lot more nuance on a short notice, basically, more than I would expect. But there were also times where it was really dragging and you could feel like, okay, so this is what it feels like when you're just trying to fill time and the storylines you have don't require this much screen time to wrap themselves up. And
right.
So it was overall enjoyable, but really interesting to kind of watch with that mindset of like, what must it have been like to be tasked with do it again?
but there's no book this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a tricky thing. I remember watching Broadchurch, the British show.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first season was such a closed story. And then the second season, I said, what's the second season going to be? Why would they, is it going to be a different mystery in a different town? They said, no, we're just going to continue this same story. And I thought, what? And then I watched the season. I thought, ooh, this is a really interesting way that they're doing this. And then by the third season, it was just, here's another crime that happened. It just felt like, you know, they just were, I don't know what to do now. So it's unfortunate sometimes. You just think, is your story going to be better by adding another season or not? I know you want money. I know you want to like make another thing, but think about the big picture. And
Who are you speaking to? All production companies?
Specifically Alex.
Okay. Yeah. Alex, just think about it.
Listen, I was okay with season 2 because I loved Meryl Streep being that mom and all these actresses being.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like,
yeah, like, I'm just like, fine, let's do it.
Yeah. it helps. I'm sure it helps when you have like an entire cast of amazing performers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Like, I feel like that's the reason it was like
A-list actors.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Awesome. Well, this has been our episode on Ocean's 11. Thank you everyone for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.